see this tree?
Lebanon's descent into what could end up being one of the top three worst crises in 150 years has been stunningly swift. The country's gross domestic product GDP, which measures the total output of goods and services, nosedived from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year, as per the latest Lebanon Economic Monitor released by the World Bank last week. The inaction by Lebanese authorities is not due to lack of knowledge or quality advice, but rather the failure to agree on effective policy initiatives and a political consensus that defends a bankrupt economic system, which, by the way, benefited a few for so long. The crisis has caused a grave social fallout that has pushed more than half of the population below the poverty line. The decimated purchasing power of the Lebanese pound has led to more than 40% of households reporting challenges in accessing food and other basic needs. Meanwhile, the nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the same year. Such dire socioeconomic conditions risk systematic national fallings with regional and potentially global consequences. Propelled by popular desperation and anger, impulsive protests now mark the advent of a longer period of unrest, chaos, and even a social explosion across the country as conditions continue to deteriorate. Lebanon is suffering from poor governance and a gaping lack of public accountability. To date, the country's three overlapping crises, the financial meltdown, the catastrophic Beirut port explosion, and the COVID-19 pandemic, have not been met with an effective government response. On the contrary, years of government corruption and incompetence laid the ground for Lebanon's accelerating collapse. Many observers have become habituated to Lebanon's dysfunction and perpetual sense of crisis, but Lebanon's current predicament marks a real departure from the past. Even in the worst days of the civil war, while lacking a government, Lebanese found informal ways to keep the country somewhat functioning. This time, it's a different Lebanon. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Crisis hit Lebanon over the weekend, teetered on the verge of complete chaos driven by the Lebanese pound's dramatic nosedive against the dollar that sent agitated Lebanese to the streets across the country, blocking highways with burning tires in Beirut and other areas, and attacking public utilities to protest the deteriorating economic conditions. Now, this coincided with the breakdown of public services that has left the country in total darkness, and with closed gas stations as a result of severe fuel, gasoline, and diesel shortages that have threatened to bring a complete halt to private generators on which the majority of the Lebanese public and businesses, including hospitals, depend for electricity. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saleh. Now, the collapsing Lebanese pound, which sank to a record low for the first time in Lebanon's history, trading at almost 18,000 Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar on the black market, coincided with the breakdown of the public services, as we just said, especially electricity, because there is no fuel to power the generators. No securing basic public services by any authority is like basically saying, we want chaos, go ahead and bring about the chaos to the country. Who benefits from all of this in Lebanon right now?
Hi to you, thank you for having me. As we know, everybody knows in Lebanon, and probably, most probably the Europeans, who really were the patronizing of the Lebanese political situation from the 90s with Rafiq Hariri, the martyr of Lebanon. And we know the situation in Lebanon is very miserable, it's going to abyss, and nobody would really have a kind of relief for what's going on. There are some thieves in Lebanon, especially in the political class, with their manager of this partnership between the capitalists, the bank owners, and some of the mafias of the sects in Lebanon who are leading this country into this abyss. I'm not surprised of this collapse of the Lebanese pound. I'm really anxious about the future of Lebanon after this very critical situation. The situation is not only economic situation, it's a political situation. The Americans and the Europeans, especially the French, now talking about a new mandate for Lebanon because of the political change in the region. Now we have many choices probably. First of all, we have to get rid, to reconstruct Lebanon, to get rid of all these mafias and the bank owners and this system, this capitalist or this new liberal system. Would the Americans agree? Of course not. They are not eager to see solutions in Lebanon. They are not eager to see Lebanese are satisfied with their authorities. There are no actual authorities to authorize good things or to lead the state into a safe place. Actually, I'm really hesitant to say that all these people who are the solution in their hand are the thieves of the money of the country.
Well, billions. This brings us to that worse still. Lebanon was quickly sliding into a political abyss, into a risk of instability, into social unrest. The top leaders even failed to agree on forming a cabinet, a new government, to at least rescue what's left in the country's economy. Can you explain to us the dilemma that led to the state of political deadlock in Lebanon?
Well, really, people, the Lebanese people, they have unveiled all these ambiguities in the Lebanese situation, and now they know that these people who are leading, or what so-called leaders in Lebanon, are not deserving this place or post or position because they have stolen all the money of the Lebanese. And that's why I guess the Lebanese have the right to raise their voice and go into demonstration or saying that we have no confidence, no trust whatsoever in this class. And the problem is that all these people were protected by the Americans and the French. Most of them, they have connections with the American embassy and with the Saudis. Now the Saudis raise their hand and say, well, we don't want Hariri, because they said they really said we have paid a lot of money for some of them. Well, most of them, they counted from Jaja to Hariri and others. Well, not to say about other people, because these people are really leading the situation in Lebanon into this catastrophe. And they, of course, they can't make or shape or form any new government that would lead to a solution in Lebanon and relieve people.
Well,
because
they are the problem.
Because
exactly.
They are the problem.
How could a man shaped otherwise in the media? How is it being shaped in the internal and also the foreign media? It's being shown that there is a dilemma, there is a problem, a bickering problem between the President Aoun and the Premier designate Saad al-Hariri, who by the way has been designated since October 22, 2020. Now they are trading accusations, each one is just pointing to the other being of blame. And one wants to form a cabinet of non-partisan specialists to enact reforms and salvage the country from an all-out economic collapse, while the other seemingly wants to secure what is called in the media the Christian rights. What's the main reason for this statement?
The main reason?
If Hariri actually has internal and external support, then what does President Aoun want?
Let's say it frankly. For once and for all, President Aoun came to the presidency in order to reform and make some ameliorations to the system, and he could not, because this mafia in these authorities, in the state, they have prevented and blocked any kind of reformation, because they have taken the money of the country. They have stolen the money of the country. How could they help General Aoun, President Aoun, in order to reform? That's the problem, I guess, because also with the political reasoning that would say General Aoun really stood by the resistance in Lebanon, and he did not do what the French and the Saudis want to do in Syria. All this, they are punishing these people, the environment, the embracive environment of the resistance in Lebanon. And I guess this is a kind of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. What would they do in the future in order to solve the situation, because their men are really the problem? Would they agree, the French, and they are putting now some sanctions on their men, would that solve the situation? Well, I really don't know.
One more minute in this segment, Dr. Saleh, but the pound has lost more than 90% of its value, and the basic items have skyrocketed in prices. Do you think that we are looking at the biggest social and economic catastrophe, actually, in West Asia, or is there still time to salvage something?
Well, we are in turmoil. I guess the Americans want to see this kind of turmoil in Lebanon and in Syria and in Iraq and other places, also in Yemen. They are really putting sanctions in order to these states to collapse.
Seems they are succeeding, though.
I guess the peoples of the West Asian countries, they can rebuild and reconstruct these countries because they are the heritage of the Americans and the French. We have one choice only, to get rid of these peoples of between brackets, the Americans and the French and the Saudis, and mm-hmm. without kicking out these people from the decision maker of in Lebanon and in other places in Iraq or in Yemen, the Hadi and his gangs, I guess without that we can't rebuild mm-hmm. these countries and the region. And we are peoples are trying, resisting all this kind of hegemony from the 20th century till now. Peoples are going in the right track.
Hopefully so. Thank you very much from Beirut, Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator, for being with us to talk about the economic and social collapse in Lebanon. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marbo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Now, the Yemeni armed forces announced earlier last week a military operation targeting Saudi forces, where days after the announcement, the Yemeni military media broadcasted scenes from the operation of the Yemeni armed forces targeting this camp of the Saudi coalition with dozens of Qassam 2K drones in the Al-Wadi'a border area. Now, spokesperson Brigadier General Yahya Al-Sariya announced the killing of a number of Saudi officers and the killing of more than 60 fighters in the ranks of the Saudi coalition aggression. In this large-scale military operation, more in this following report.
Clashes intensified during the past week between the Yemeni armed forces and forces loyal to the outgoing President Abdullah Mansour Hadi within the Rahwan district, the second largest district of Ma'rib governorate, which extends from northwest to west. This came in the wake of Hadi's forces violating a tribal truce signed in earlier March 2020 between Sana'a forces and some of the leaders of the Rahwan tribes, which stipulated the commitment of the army and popular committees not to attack the district's areas that had been neutralized from the ongoing confrontations. Under the agreement signed by the Marwan and the Shadawda tribes, the largest of the Rahwan tribes, which held for more than a year before Hadi forces violated it, Sana'a granted the people of the district the right to protect and manage their own security. However, the transformation of a number of areas of Rahuan district into a launching pad for the operations of Hadi forces and the Islah Party militias had little effect on the course of the confrontations on the western and southwestern fronts, where the skirmishes declined in the past 2 days. Meanwhile, the Yemeni armed forces were able to make new military progress west of the Khanjar camp, specifically in the Khub and Al-Shaga front of Al-Jawf governorate. The military media center in Sana'a published audio and video documented scenes that showed the army and the popular committees in the area, in addition to showing scores of dead and injured Saudi mercenaries. In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Saria, confirmed that the drone air force was able to carry out a massive military operation targeting a training camp of the Saudi Emirati coalition in the Al-Wadi'a area, with 10 Qasif 2K drones targeting the command center, training sites, and sectors. Saria pointed out that the operation, which was documented by video and audio, led to the killing of a Saudi officer and 60 members of Saudi mercenaries, including a number of military leaders. According to military sources in Sana'a, the targeted camp is under the supervision of the Central Military Command in the region and enjoys high protection and advanced technological security via American satellites. Saria made it clear that targeting Al-Wadi'a camp was a message to Washington that will be followed by other messages during the upcoming period of fighting to liberate all of Maghreb. Now to discuss this issue with us from Sydney is author and academic Dr. Tim Anderson. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Anderson. Now, footage of the Yemeni Armed Forces media showed the Yemeni Qasif 2K arriving at the scene inside the Al-Wadi'a military camp, which is a very, very important camp on the border with Yemen, while Saudi soldiers and their mercenaries were fleeing. Whoever was left of them fled for their lives. Now, the Yemeni Armed Forces have been targeting Saudi military bases for a long time now. Why was this operation very significant for the Yemeni Armed Forces?
It's another step, really, in the Yemeni forces taking over parts of Najran, moving into area that has been disputed for a long time, but in any case, currently Saudi territory. So there's strong support they have also from some of the people there. So, and the use of the drones that you mentioned, as you said, has been used before against other Saudi military bases.
Well, during the same week, Yemeni army forces launched two missile strikes against the position of Saudi-led militants in Yemen's very strategic central province of Maghreb, which is witnessing right now huge operations. They killed and wounded dozens of those mercenaries. Many reason might be behind the choice to take the time to liberate Maghreb, because it's been over 5 months now that the operation of Maghreb had started. However, if you want to break down the situation in this major city, which is bordering Saudi Arabia, why do you think that the Yemeni armed forces led by the resistance forces of Ansarullah are taking their time to liberate Maghreb?
I don't think it's completely correct to say that they're taking their time. They've actually made a number of statements to say that we're going to, you know, move very quickly, and they wanted to move very quickly. But as you say, it's an extremely heavy battle, and it's the biggest stakes in the north of Yemen, really, because this is the one base that the Hadi so-called government based in Riyadh has. In other words, everything that the Saudis have been doing has been trying to reinforce this one significant base on the ground. And if and when Ansarullah-led forces take Maghreb, that is going to change the complexion in the entire region, basically. And as you say, there's been heavy battle, that there's been a lot of airstrikes on the forces coming in from the west, and the Yemeni revolutionary government is using ballistic missiles also against their targets there. I've read that there's been thousands of casualties there, so I don't think their aim is to slow it down. In fact, they are making some moves in other parts of the country at the same time, but this is a really the big battle in the north of Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, one very interesting thing happened last week was the breaking of an agreement that happened between the Yemeni armed forces and the biggest tribes of Maghreb, because the mercenaries of Saudi Arabia broke that agreement and started shooting from those specific areas after long talks happened between Ansarullah and these tribes, and they all agreed that they should not fight.
You think that Mohammed bin Salman is now trying to maneuver something new to maybe bring new enemies for Ansarullah to the table?
Well, there's always the aim to try and divide and carve out sections of the country. I mean, you know, that Hadi himself was the one who was trying to move back to a six-part partition of the country under Saudi direction. So they'll keep doing that. But I think there's a measure of desperation coming from Riyadh now, because they are losing on so many fronts. And the revolutionary government is making incursions into the south now at the same time. So they are fighting on more than one front.
Well, the Swedish foreign minister landed in Riyadh last week, where she met with Saudi foreign minister Faisal bin Farhan. And for God knows what reason, she met with Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, the ousted Yemeni president. Now, she tweeted that the discussions were concerning the peace efforts in Yemen for bilateral issues and for humanitarian issues as well as humanitarian rights. Now, Saudi Arabia is still bombing Yemen. It's blockading the country, aerial, sea, land blockades, and it's sending even more mercenaries to occupy the country. What peace efforts is she talking about?
Well, the problem is that there is a very bad Security Council resolution, I think it's 2216 from 2015, which frames the whole conflict as though what they call the Houthis are the problem, basically an outside problem, and somehow enshrines Hadi as legitimate president of Yemen. Now, Hadi had an interim role in 2012 through 2014, but somehow this Security Council resolution from 2015 has enshrined forever the role of this exiled junta in Riyadh as the legitimate government. And so the language being used, and you see it in the Persian Gulf press and the Western press, the Yemeni government this, the Yemeni government that, they're talking about a regime, or not even a regime, but a group of people in Riyadh, basically, as the Yemeni government. So when other agents, including those, you know, looking at the UN security resolution, come in, there's a very difficult structure there to deal with. And, you know, what the Ansarullah revolutionary government has said, that they'll agree to a ceasefire if the blockade is lifted, unfortunately is undermined by this very bad Security Council resolution from 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, Oman has been long perceived as a neutral party in the part of West Asia, and has spent the past few weeks attempting to get Saudi Arabia and Yemen to the negotiating table to find an end to the ongoing suffering of the Yemeni people. Now, the Yemeni conditions for any ceasefire, just like you just mentioned, are fixed. They are not negotiable. Ansarullah said it clearly by the movement's leader, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. He said, lift the siege, halt all forms of aggression, just stop bombing the same place hundreds of times, and end the occupation. I think that these are reasonable. Even if I want to stand by the Yemenis, if I want to look, I want to take a different position and be objective about it, they seem very logical conditions there. What is the next move for Yemen in the event that Mohammed bin Salman just chooses to move forward with the aggression instead of accepting the reality and just giving up on his psychopathic warmongering policies?
It's very difficult. He's in a very difficult situation. Let's say the Saudi rulers are in a very difficult situation because they are losing on several fronts. They're having their own territory, incursions into what they consider their own territory, as well as about to lose Marib, which is going to be a very big blow to them. And of course, the Emirates and Israel are in the south, you know, and there's some some movement going on there, let's say, in favor of the revolutionary government. So the Saudis have been suing for peace for some time because they know that they're losing, but they're hanging on to those shreds of so-called legitimacy that the UN gives them and that their Western backers are hanging on to, really. So, but nevertheless, the Saudis know that they're losing. They've gone to Iran, they've gone to Oman, they're doing talks, they're looking for peace. And in the meantime, as you say, the revolutionary government has put a very reasonable position. And while that's not met, they are simply going ahead with what they're going ahead with, and they're making more progress, basically. And this is, the problem is the legitimacy battle going on internationally is going to try and sheet home responsibility to, you know, their favoured party. And so that's the dilemma in terms of the international debate.
Well, it seems that we are looking ahead to very decisive weeks ahead in liberating Ma'arib and see where things go for the action negotiations to move forward. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tim Anderson, author and academic, for joining us from Sydney to talk about the latest developments in Yemen. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. A group of Texas Democratic lawmakers plan to flee their state in a desperate bid to stop the Republican-run legislature from passing laws that they say will suppress the vote of people of color. We have prepared for you an article written by Sam Levine. The piece is titled Texas Democrats Planning to Flee the State to Thwart Voting Restrictions Law. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Texas Democrats plan to flee the state as part of an all-out effort to block Republicans from passing new restrictions on voting in the state of Texas. The move, first reported by NBC News, escalates one of the most high-stakes battles over efforts to make it harder to vote in America. It comes just days into a special legislative session in Texas in which Republicans are advancing measures that would impose new identification requirements on mail-in ballots, ban 24-hour and drive-through voting, and empower partisan poll watchers. Texas, a state Donald Trump handily won in 2020, is already one of the hardest places to vote in the United States. It is among a handful of states that do not have online voter registration nor does it allow everyone to vote by mail, only allowing those who are 65 years old, have a disability, or who meet other criteria to do so. Texas was among the states with the lowest turnout in the 2020 presidential election. This will be the second time Texas lawmakers have walked out of the Capitol to deny Republicans the required two-thirds quorum needed to conduct business. In late May, Democrats walked out of the regular session of the legislature, thwarting an earlier version of the voting bill. Republicans have pressed on with a similar version of that bill in the special session, though they dropped two of its most egregious provisions, a measure cutting early voting hours on Saturdays and another that would have made it easier for judges to overturn elections. The Democratic decision to flee the state offered a jolt of energy to national Democrats who have watched Republicans across the country use their majorities in state capitals to enact several new measures to impose voting restrictions. While Democrats have failed in their efforts in Washington to pass comprehensive voting rights legislation, NBC News reported several of the Democrats fleeing Texas plan to travel to Washington, D.C. to advocate for federal voting legislation. Democratic leaders in the State House of Representatives said in a statement, "We're now taking the fight to our nation's capital. We are living on borrowed time in Texas." They urged Congress to pass the For the People Act, which includes several provisions that would expand voter access, as well as an updated version of the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act. Gilberto Hinojosa, the chairman of the Texas Democratic Party, supported lawmakers as they left the state. He said in a statement, "We will not stand by and watch Republicans slash our right to vote, silence the voices of Texans of color, and destroy our democracy, all to preserve their own power. Our lawmakers have refused to be complicit in Republicans' destructive attacks, and they're doing what Texans need them to do, hold the line so that not one more anti-voter law can be passed in Texas." With no quorum, Republicans in the state legislature will be unable to proceed with any business in the special session, which can last a maximum of 30 days. According to NBC News, Democrats who flee the state face potential arrest as state Republicans can authorize law enforcement to haul the Democratic legislators back to the state. Republicans did just that in 2003 when Democratic lawmakers fled the state in an effort to block new electoral maps that would favor Republicans. Dade Phelan, a Republican and a Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, said Republicans would use every available resource under the state constitution and rules of the House to secure a quorum. If needed, the rules of the Texas House allow legislatures to authorize the sergeant-at-arms to arrest lawmakers to secure a quorum. He said in a statement, "These actions put at risk state funding that will deny thousands of hardworking staff members and their families a paycheck, health benefits, and retirement investment, so that legislators who broke quorum can flee to Washington, D.C. in private jets." He added, "The special session clock is ticking. I expect all members to be present in our capital in order to immediately get to work on these issues." The New York Times reported as recently as last week that there was not widespread consensus among Democrats on whether to flee the state. The New York Times said some Democrats, realizing they could not block Republicans from passing new restrictions forever, favored staying and fighting the legislation on procedural grounds and proposing amendments to win key concessions. Some worried that fleeing the state would make it look like Democrats were abandoning their legislative responsibilities. Those in favor of fleeing argued it would bring new spotlight on the fight over voting rights in Texas. NBC News reported 58 of the 67-member Democratic caucus are expected to flee the state. Republicans began advancing the new voting bill on Saturday, 10th of July, in a committee hearing that lasted into the early hours of the Sunday morning. Hundreds of people signed up to testify against the measure and waited hours to do so. In 2003, Democrats in the state legislature fled to Oklahoma and New Mexico in an effort to block Republicans from passing new electoral maps that benefited Republicans. Republicans were eventually able to get a quorum when a Democratic state senator broke ranks with his colleagues and returned to the Capitol. Reports at the time noted the difficulties lawmakers faced in being out of the state for so long. Some did not pack enough clothes. They also paid for hotel rooms out of pocket and refused to take a per diem. Texas Republicans also stripped Democrats of their parking spaces at the Capitol while they were out of the state and threatened to tow the car of one state senator. There have been walkouts over controversial pieces of legislation in other states in recent years. For example, in 2011, Wisconsin Democrats fled the state over the anti-union bill, prompting the state Senate to authorize law enforcement to bring them back. Republicans maneuvered to pass the bill anyway. In 2019, Republicans in the Oregon legislature have also fled the Capitol in recent years in fights over climate bills.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: مودة الآباء قرابة بين الأبناء، والقرابة إلى المودة أحوج من المودة إلى القرابة.
Imam Ali said, mutual affection between fathers creates a relationship between the sons. Relationship is more in need of affection than affection is of relationship. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, we learn a very great many things from Imam Ali alayhi salam's universal persona. And one of them is that he is the source of knowledge. He was the foremost in Islam. He was patient and forbearing. And so we too, dear friends, must be patient and forbearing. Beyond a doubt, Imam Ali alayhi salam was more patient and more forbearing than all of the people, of course, after the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. The best proof is the fact that Imam Ali was deprived of his right and an unjust rule was imposed upon him. Nevertheless, he adopted patience and restrained his anger. Dear friends, it is very important for us to find ways to restrain our anger. It is also very important for us to remain patient and to remain forbearing when it comes to people and their mistakes. And of course, we must be patient when it comes to trials and tribulations in our lives. It is interesting, but despite the fact that there were certain elements and certain factors which deprived Imam Ali alayhi salam of his right to be at the head of the government of the Muslims, he remained patient. He showed composure. We do not find that Imam Ali alayhi salam in any way became overtly angry, and we do not find that he ever committed an unjust act upon those people who committed injustice against him. So, dear friends, despite the trials and tribulations, despite the annoyances in our daily lives, whether it is our own fault or the fault of others, we must always remember to be patient for the sake of Allah, to show forbearance for the sake of Allah, to restrain our anger when it is unjust, and to adopt patience wherever we can. Now, patience doesn't necessarily mean to be inactive, to be passive, to do nothing. No, patience, dear friends, means to be active, to remain steadfast, to be determined upon the path. Beautiful lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتبيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani l-ayn rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter 3 of the Quran, in verse number 33, makes an announcement where he says, Inna Allah astafa, verily God has chosen Adam and then Nuh. And then the family of Abraham, and then Imran, alal alameen, over the rest of the people in the world. When you look at this verse of the Quran, you come to realize that all human beings have been created by Almighty God, but they are not equal in the eyes of God. As far as their status is concerned, you know, when it comes to the prophets of God, the messengers of God, those who represent Him, in conveying his message, they are at a higher, you know, status than other human beings. I would like to take this opportunity to actually talk about the special status that God has given to Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. And when I am talking about this special status, we are talking about the Muslim community, which is known as the Ummah. So you have the Ummah there, and then you have the family of the Prophet. They are not equal when it comes to their honor, you know, and their prestige and the grace that God has given to them. Yes, Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt, they are human beings like us. But there is a big difference between us and them. And that is what I would like to talk tonight, you know, from the Islamic point of view. But before that, let me just give you an example. You know, when you look at the car companies, they manufacture vehicles of different category. You know, they have the cars or the vehicles that they produce in large number for the common market. But then they also have a luxury line, which is of limited edition. And there is a difference between the common car that the same company is building and the limited version of the vehicles that they produce. When you look at the two, you know, categories of the vehicles that the same company is producing, you will see that there would be many parts which would be common between the two because it's coming from the same factory. But then the limited edition of the vehicles have something which is not found in the other, you know, class of the vehicles. And this is where it makes it special, limited version. It is on a higher class than the common, you know, vehicles that they produce. When we look at Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt on one side, and when we look at the rest of the Muslim, you know, Ummah, the community and the humanity at large, we do realize that, yes, when it comes to the physical structure of all human beings, including Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt, they are all same. They also feel hunger and thirst. They are not, you know, angels, or they are not robots. No, they are also human beings like us. If somebody injures them by a spear or a sword, they will also bleed like anyone else. They will also feel the pain. But then there is something extra on a spiritual level in Muhammad and his Ahlul Bayt, which is not in us. And that is what we have to realize, that they are human beings like us, but not exactly in the total manner. There is something that they have, which God has given to them, which he has not given to us. And one of the most obvious, you know, quality that they have, which cannot be acquired, it can only be gifted by Almighty God to those whom he would choose, that is the power of the spirituality known as ismat and infallibility. It is the purity of their soul and the excellence in their character. And this is where we see that sometimes even the laws of Islam would change for them compared to the rest of the Muslims. And this is where we will see that the distinction that God has given to Ahlul Bayt over the Ummah, which is the, you know, the larger community of the world of Islam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.